So it's 995-995-99. Thanks for listening, and we hope you join us at the LSB meeting May 12th at 7 p.m. The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays after the WBAI Evening News at 6:30 p.m. It is now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It's 7 o'clock, time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Oh, they live on for the best, it's fake for the worst. I hope that's understood, but maybe no.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Obviously.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Gila.
Hello.
And Alex.
Hello, hello.
You know, it's getting closer to the point where we're going to be back in the studio as New York City begins to reopen, and I don't know, it's kind of daunting to think about this, that these days of remote broadcasting might be drawing to an end soon.
It does feel pretty heavy. I can't remember the last time I've been in Brooklyn. Actually, I think it was for the last show we did in the studio.
Yeah.
And considering you're in Queens, that's a statement, because it's not far away. It's not far away. It'll be weird. It'll be weird to start seeing things again, start seeing people again. And that, you know, I think we should have eased into it. You know, not try to bite off too much at once. It'll be good to see everybody again, though, and hopefully we're all getting the vaccine. If we have not gotten it already, please, people, continue to do this. That is key. That is key in getting back to normal. The only reason we're at this stage now is because so many of you went out and got the vaccine.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, look, but I'm also on the fence about going back to the studio too. I started to really enjoy, you know, having these remote sessions and being able to do this from Pennsylvania, you know, with the fire going in the background. You know, being back in Brooklyn will be great. I'm just glad we're not going back to that old studio. I mean, I think how many shows did we actually do in the new studio before this global health crisis? Well,
which old studio? We've got so many old studios. Which one do you mean?
I'm talking about the one where you could hear people in the hallway while we were on the air, and the ceiling didn't even rise to the ceiling.
Oh, I like that. I like that studio. Yeah, you always knew what was going on, both in the in the station and out in the street. Every time there was a fire engine that went by or an airplane that went over, we'd hear it. Our listeners would hear it. It's just kind of, we were plugged in.
Yeah, you felt connected to the community and several different, that's on several different levels. But how many shows did we do in the new studio that had the right baffling, that had the soundproof windows, you know, and didn't have the background of fire engines?
One. We did one show. We did one show that went well. That
was it. One?
One. It was one.
Oh my God. Wow.
No, it was a lot more than that, Alex. Wow. Okay.
It was a couple of months.
It was.
That's kind of a year.
Oh, no, we only did a couple of shows in the new studio, if I recall.
A lot. Yeah, a couple of months of
lot.
Shows.
Yeah. So we'll be disagreeing on all sorts of things, I guess, once we meet in person. But we can disagree remotely tonight, and I think we're going to be doing a bit of that. We're going to be talking about the whole Facebook decision, which I can't believe I have to say it like that. But, yeah, Facebook made a decision today. We're going to discuss and analyze that. There are a bunch of other things. I'd like to start with some good news, though, if that's possible. I'm on sort of a good news kick this week. Turns out the United States will be supporting a proposal to waive intellectual property protections for the COVID-19 vaccines, joining an effort to increase global supply and access to the life-saving shots as the gap between rich and poor nations widens, if you can believe that. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said, "We are for the waiver at the WTO. We are for what the proponents of the waiver are trying to accomplish, which is better access, more manufacturing capability, more shots in arms." It seems like common sense. But believe it or not, well, actually, you probably will believe it, the stock of Pfizer and all the pharmaceutical companies plunged today as soon as that news came out. And it just makes you realize, wow, you know, stopping a global pandemic really goes against the interests of these pharmaceutical companies, doesn't it?
I think, you know, to an extent, right? I mean, it's about expectations of profit, right? And not being able to profit as substantially from the intellectual property that they develop, certainly it will make a dent, I think, temporarily in the share price. I would expect it to bounce back up.
Yeah, it should. But that reaction, I cannot imagine anyone not being behind getting the vaccine out to as many people as humanly possible. That is the key, because we all benefit from that, and that is a positive step.
This is one of the areas that I don't think should lead as far as a pandemic is concerned in global and national public health. Interests of shareholders really do not lie with the vast majority of people out there, and their decision making processes aren't, I think, very well suited to what benefits the most of us.
Well, the U.S. is not the only country that until now has withheld support for the waiver. The European Union, UK, Japan, Switzerland, Brazil, and Norway also have resisted the push, but supporters of the waiver argue that U.S. leadership on the issue could help sway other holdouts, and certainly public pressure can also contribute to that. So important that this not be held up by ridiculous IP protections in this really global crisis that we are still facing.
Yeah, it really illustrates how broken late stage capitalism is, that there are people in the world who were thinking, gee, I sure hope that the entire world doesn't get access free and clear to the things that will save us from this pandemic, because it means my shareholder value will go down a little. But that's what it is. But like, even looking at it from a completely practical capitalist perspective, like, all of these companies still have the marketing value, the sheer bragging rights of being able to say, hey, remember when we saved everyone from that pandemic, the greatest medical threat to face the world at large in any, you know, in recent memory? Remember when we did that? They could put that in all their TV commercials from now until, doomsday and be fine. So
no, exactly.
I'm sure they'll be all right.
There's always a way you can spin the story and to make your shareholders happy. But that's not the issue. The issue is getting the vaccine out, and it's super important that this continue. So that might be a big step forward. Let's hope it is. Facebook. They had an oversight board, very mysterious, I think 20-member oversight board, that today was supposed to make a decision on whether they would keep Donald Trump banned. This is a stupid story. It really is, because why do we care so much about this? But that's what it's turned into. That's what it's become. The fact that Facebook is this all-seeing entity now that dictates who speaks and who doesn't speak. Their oversight board, which acts as a quasi-court over the company's content decisions, ruled that the social network was right to bar Mr. Trump after the insurrection in Washington in January, saying he created an environment where a serious risk of violence was possible. The panel said that ongoing risk justified the move. And in my opinion, they have every right to ban whoever they want. You can disagree, but this is their decision. And I think it was the right decision. But the board also kicked the case back to Facebook and its top executives. It said that an indefinite suspension was not appropriate because it was not a penalty defined in Facebook's policies, and that the company should apply a standard punishment such as a time-bound suspension or a permanent ban. The board gave Facebook 6 months to make a final decision on Mr. Trump's account status. Okay, granted, this is a stupid story. Who cares about Trump's Facebook status? But the fact of the matter is, millions and millions of people are directly affected by this. Their actions are dictated by this. And we could well be talking about insurrections being planned as a result of him speaking on these forums that reach so many people. It's we're talking about power here. Too much power should not be in the hands of one company, absolutely. But that's where it is right now. And what do you guys think? Permanent suspension? Should it be reinstated? Any strong thoughts?
Hey, look, from my perspective, you know, this is a fascinating legal evolution here, where what we essentially have is a corporate tribunal, a corporate judiciary making decisions that can bind a private company. And the decisions of essentially Facebook Supreme Court, its oversight board, which is comprised of journalists, of lawyers, of activists, it's an interesting cross-section. But remember, they're still, you know, they're not public employees. These are people that are dealing specifically with Facebook for Facebook. But those decisions are generally to hold Facebook accountable to its own policies. So from that perspective, this decision should not have surprised anybody. The law that they are applying are Facebook's own rules and regulations, the policies that they set forth for themselves and their users with respect to a very narrow issues, namely content moderation. So by Facebook banning Trump indefinitely, they didn't hold true to their policies. They're kicking it back to Facebook. And I think now this punt will give Facebook the opportunity to assess down the road. I wouldn't expect them to make a snap decision on this. I think they would probably take their time, make a decision probably 4 or 5, possibly 6 months down the road to determine what the political climate is like, what Donald Trump is like, and whether it would make sense to have that type of content back on their platform. Because if having that type of content back on their platform will support the bottom line, then they will probably make that decision. Again, here we are talking about shareholders in the interest, the best interest of their shareholders. Yet on the other hand, one other contrary point, a quick one I want to make is, this is also interesting from a transparency perspective, because these are judicially reasoned opinions. They set out the facts, albeit these facts are 5 months old now. Actually, I guess we're about 4 months old now. And it seems like it's kind of stale, but at least we have something tangible that we can hold in our hands and physically read that sets out the reasoning of a private company like Facebook that wields an enormous amount of power over billions of users worldwide.
And that, I think, is the real issue, that enormous amount of power over billions of users, not one idiot who doesn't know how to behave himself in public. And as far as how he is treated, he should be treated as others would be treated if they do the same thing, those special privileges. And I think that's what he has received over the past few years. My question is, why didn't Facebook act sooner based on their own rules and regulations and take disciplinary action for all the things he was doing there? Gila, go ahead.
Something actually very interesting happened today with respect to all of this, and it's not a Facebook issue, but what it is, someone attempted, and I don't know if it was legit, I don't know if it was real, but someone apparently set up a Twitter account for Donald Trump that was echoing the blog posts on his website. It was feeding that material directly to Twitter.
It took 4 months for someone to figure out how to do that?
The blog is new, as far as I can tell.
Right, but his mouth isn't, and he's constantly saying something, and I would imagine that somebody would set something up quickly to just, you know, forward everything he says, every utterance.
But it went up yesterday or today, mm-hmm. and as of 5 minutes ago, the account's been suspended. So I think the question of what, you know, not getting special treatment, if you had an account that was suspended for hate speech, provocation, insurrection, incitement, whatever, and then you attempt to create a new account if you were any random person off the street and attempted to backdoor it in the same way, mm-hmm. you'd get kicked off the site. So this got shut down.
Here's
I would hope that that sort of thing could be equally applied.
Well, my question on this, I'm kind of interested in what you're describing here, is someone simply forwarding the words that he is saying on his website? And is that enough to get you kicked off of Twitter if you simply forward what he says, assuming that speech itself isn't violating any terms of service? Is that enough to get you kicked off?
It's an excellent question. I mean, there were people who, when he still had an active Twitter account, were creating accounts that just retweeted what he tweeted to see how long it would take them to get kicked off. People are getting suspended within 12 hours.
Yeah, the thing is, they don't have the followers. If one of us went on and just started regurgitating what he says, how is anyone going to think that that's the same thing as him controlling an account? No, the same amount of people won't be able to see it. It seems like this is something that Twitter might want to rethink.
Absolutely. I mean, this seemed to be set up very, like, the name of the account was The Desk of Donald J. Trump, and it was set up to look very official.
Okay.
So even if it wasn't, if it wasn't, it's a great feat of social engineering, but it looks official.
Well, that's why. So, okay, the Desk of Donald, if that's what it's called, then I could certainly see that getting attention and potentially getting a lot of followers because people would believe it. But it was just, John Smith 237 saying the same things off the website. I would hope that would not be enough to get that user kicked off just for saying those words that came from that person.
No, but this to be set up is, this is what Donald Trump is saying. Mm-hmm. And we're going to, the description, I'm sorry, is posts copied from Save America on behalf of the 45th POTUS, originally composed via DonaldJTrump.com/desk. This account distributes the forum onto Twitter.
Yeah, that's probably enough because that's kind of stating intent.
Very straightforward.
Yeah. I would think so. Alex, what do you think of this oversight board of Facebook? It's a mystery, right? Nobody knows who's on it.
I think people have come out and said that they're on it and whatnot. But I think it's an interesting innovation here. But their motivations, I think, have to be questioned in a sense. I'd like to know what their compensation is. I'd like to know, how much collective input and how these deliberations actually happen, and also. The remit of the Facebook Oversight Board generally seems to be focused on content itself and about making considered decisions about difficult issues, for instance, like about QAnon conspiracy theories, being allowed to propagate on the platform, vaccine-related misinformation, political figures like Donald Trump. And what the Facebook Oversight Board decides may have a spillover effect on other platforms as well. It may have some kind of precedent-setting effect, and I think Facebook is hoping for this and being the first of these social media platforms to create essentially what is a corporate tribunal acting as a Supreme Court. They can actually overrule decisions of Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg could say, I think Trump should be reinstated right now, and the Facebook Oversight Board could actually overrule that particular decision. So from a corporate governance perspective, it's quite an interesting innovation. I'm not entirely sure we're going to see this replicated on other platforms because it's also very tricky to deal with. They're going to have their own case law. They're going to have public decisions. A lot of this transparency is not necessarily in the best interest of these platforms. So on one hand, I do think we have to hand it to Facebook for making an effort at transparency and putting this entire thing together in somewhat short form.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I think it really gives a huge amount of allusion to the addressing or to the oversight and transparency is lost, I think, in the process. And we're transferring the power to this group, but it is the sort of exercise, and I think it's silly, but the exercise of establishing standards that they didn't have, that they broke, that they screwed up on. Like, these are punitive. And in fact, like, I feel like it's a childish exercise that we have to listen to it and speak about it as though it's news or as though it's an innovation. And, you know, why should this group have that power? Why should they then step in to be the illusion of bridling Mark Zuckerberg's omnipresence in whatever his gigantic, the point of his gigantic company is? And I feel that this is an inflection over what are they for? What is the point of all of this? Who is really benefiting and how is the technology being leveraged and who is at the effect of it? Because I suspect, and I have suspected for a while, we've all pointed out how large and out of control a lot of these massive technology firms are. And that's what they bill themselves as. And in fact, and I looked in a long time ago at some of the projects, and one in particular struck me is the, open compute plans on the hardware that Facebook was developing in-house. And not only are they building their own hardware, because apparently, like, other vendors can't provide it, and they feel they can't stop disrupting, so they go ahead, design their own stuff, and then give away the plans. And it's great, but then you think about it. Who's buying this? Like, who is building from open compute plans? Who can afford any of that? What is the practicality? And since when did rating your friends on a social media network have anything to do with this deployment of tech? Kind of like Netflix emerged needing hardware. What do they need all of this for? And who cares? Like, what? Where? When did this become their lane? And I think those kinds of moments should have been perhaps writing on the wall or a sign to some of us that they're just throwing money around and will in one moment do it with lawyers, in another moment buying companies or stock or whatever it is. But it's that power that E pointed out. It's maintaining it. And this is what it is. They want to stay a hegemon.
Well, good word, by the way. It's whenever we look at a company like Facebook and wonder how they got so big, how they got so controlling, we're the reason. We give it to them. We let them do this. You know, every now and then, I have a Facebook account. Who doesn't? But I don't use it. But I am, you might think I'm logged in, but I'm actually, I just keep a presence on there so I can use a name client that still connects to Facebook contacts. But occasionally I just go onto my timeline and look at what's going on. And I see all these momentous events in people's lives that I know, people that I talk to. And I'm not hearing about it in person. I'm not hearing about it in any other place. I have to go on Facebook to find out who got married, who contracted COVID, who's died, all sorts of things. Every time I look, I'm surprised. Why didn't anybody talk about this or say something? We're allowing Facebook to become the dominant means of communication. That is very unhealthy. It's one company. You know, we're talking about how Facebook might have done the right thing in banning an evil like Donald Trump, but they're an evil as well. A different kind of evil. You know, it's not a either or situation, but that amount of power, it's never a good thing. It's never a good thing to give any entity that kind of power. And, you know, actually, there's another story that I'd like to devote a little bit of time to concerning our friends over at Signal. They tried a little mischief with Facebook. They wrote this piece. Companies like Facebook aren't building technology for you. They're building technology for your data. They collect everything they can from Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp in order to sell visibility into people and their lives. This isn't exactly a secret, but the full picture is hazy to most, dimly concealed within complex, opaquely rendered systems and fine print designed to be scrolled past. The way most of the internet works today would be considered intolerable if translated into comprehensible, real-world analogs, but it endures because it is invisible. And this is part of this piece that was written by one of their developers, and what we have here are examples of exactly that, translating this spying on us into phrases that you can understand. Okay, I'm going to read an example. You got this ad because you're a K-pop loving chemical engineer. This ad used your location to see you're in Berlin and you have a new baby and just moved and you're really feeling those pregnancy exercises lately. Imagine seeing that on your screen. Yeah, Facebook's own tools have the power to divulge what is otherwise unseen. It's already possible to catch fragments of these truths in the ads you're shown. They're glimmers that reflect the world of a surveilling stranger who knows you. We wanted to use those same tools to directly highlight how most technology works. We wanted to buy some Instagram ads. And that is what they did. Here's another one. You got this ad because you're a teacher. But more importantly, you're a Leo and single. This ad used your location to see you're in Moscow. You like to support sketch comedy, and this ad thinks you do drag. Yeah, we created a multivariant targeted ad designed to show you the personal data that Facebook collects about you and sells access to. The ad will simply display some of the information collected about the viewer, which the advertising platform uses. Well, guess what? Facebook was not into that idea. Now, cut them off. Facebook is more than willing to sell visibility into people's lives, unless it's to tell people about how their data is being used. Being transparent about how ads use people's data is apparently enough to get banned. In Facebook's world, the only acceptable usage is to hide what you're doing from your audience. So, that is what happens when you expose Facebook for who they are and what they're doing. And hats off to JUNH3, I don't know how to pronounce that, at Signal for putting this together and learning something about what Facebook is really up to. Rob?
Yeah, the developer in question, whose name is Jun Harada, it's a brilliant blog post, which you can see on signal.org. And it also opens up part of what we were talking about before with the Trump issue, which is that people are looking to Facebook, which is all pervasive, all encompassing. You asked before who doesn't have a Facebook. I don't. But even then, like, Facebook, I'm sure, knows who I am and knows who my friends are and knows what ads to serve me if I'm around, because that's the way it all works. That's the way we've let it get. And now they're on a level where they have like this pseudo governmental power, and they're doing these tribunals in sort of a parody of a due process, in sort of a spoof of government and, you know, justice to basically just cement that that role in everyone's head. People on a certain side are willing to say, like, Facebook is blocking Trump. That's against free speech. What about my free speech? And it's nothing to do with free speech. And, you know, no one's stopping you from rolling up your own website and writing whatever you want on it. But a company like making decisions to just say, we do want this, we don't want this on our platform, and then wrapping it up in this big costume of a public utility is kind of ridiculous, and I think that needs as much exposing as possible, as do practices like in these Instagram ads. And I really got to take my hat off to Signal for what they've done here.
I absolutely agree. I admit it. I'm a pretty active Facebook user.
Are there things Rob doesn't know about because you only talk about it on Facebook? He's sitting right next to you.
Actually,
but that's what I'm talking about. That's what happens.
Facebook knows who Rob is. I'm not Rob is all over my Facebook profile. That's just how life is. But a few years ago, I remember getting served an ad for singlemuslim.com. And I said, interesting. So Facebook knows I'm single and Facebook knows I'm religious. I am not Muslim. But I said, this is interesting that this. So I've begun clicking on why did I get served this ad? And they don't give you most of the information. It's like, you're a woman and you live in the United States. And it's fascinating to me that the pieces of information that come, this is why I was so fascinated by the whole Signal attempt, which I still think is amazing, and what they know and how they use it. And, you know, we got married a couple years ago. Facebook keeps sending me stuff about baby clothes because they just assume.
It's time. Yeah. Facebook is telling you.
Yeah.
Listen to your overlords. Wow. You know, one thing I'd like to do is feed them fake information whenever possible. You know, you don't have to use your real name. You don't have to use your real location. What difference does it make to the people you're talking to if you tell a story that actually happened last week or maybe happened to somebody else? You know, tell the people that you actually see on a day-to-day basis, people you live with, tell them the truth. But do you really have to bear everything to everybody? I think that is, it sounds healthy, but it really isn't when there is an all-seeing eye witnessing all of this.
Got it? Yeah, it takes control. I mean, when then people realize they're being surveyed actively by the technology, by what they say, it then becomes a filter and a sort of self-censorship, and the blandness, the difference disappears, the blandness ensues, and it changes the dynamic of what people feel is acceptable in the public square, in the discourse itself. And then in comes this infusion of algorithmic power and emphasis to further change that dynamic. And I think what is really sad is a lot of the platforms, like the social networks, could have benefited from more emphasis on actually connecting people in certain ways that were positive, mm-hmm. and that and emphasized and amplified the virtuous parts of those platforms' abilities. But instead, they didn't have a model to run financially, so that this advertising scheme was grafted on when, like, Instagram was bought by Facebook. So they sort of infect a lot of these cool ideas with then their business model, again, taking the information, commodifying it. I mean, Instagram properties, now properties of Facebook, didn't necessarily have to become what they did. They did have a need for sort of market viability, but there are other models. Again, we've talked about, like, subscription methods. People, if they didn't have ads, if they knew all their friends would be there, if they felt like it was a place that they were comfortable being themselves on or being weird on and, you know, expressive, then I think, you know, there would be value, especially in opposition to what we have. That's, I think, the essence of going, how we should look at it going forward.
I think the evil really starts once you introduce advertising, because that is something that you sell your soul for, and that's what these companies appear to be doing. Imagine if, you know, social networks were kind of like Wikipedias, you know, that didn't have advertising everywhere, that relied on the support of their users. I think you'd have a much more honest communication system, much more honest social network, and not based so much on popularity and not having all sorts of surveillance performed on you. It's not a healthy environment. It's not a healthy environment on so many levels. Now, we're focusing a lot on Facebook. I'd like to focus on another evil, and this one is Google, specifically YouTube, which Google owns. There is a channel on YouTube called The Piano Keys. It's hooked up to the website, thepianokeys.com. I want you to hear the story of the owner of that organization, who is trying to teach people how to play the damn piano. You know, that's what she's doing. She has a small business doing this, and she thought it would be a good idea to play a little piece of Beethoven on her YouTube channel. Well, guess what? It didn't go so well. Let's listen in her words.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Piano Keys. I'm so glad that you're here. Well, this is a very different fifth anniversary celebration video than what I was planning on making. But unfortunately, I'm not in control here. So a few weeks ago, I posted a video that was a tutorial on how to play the rhythm in Moonlight Sonata correctly. And as part of that video, I played a bit of Moonlight Sonata. So there's a new thing at YouTube where before your video even goes live, there is an automatic scan done by some kind of AI or something that scans for copyrighted material. And before the video even went live, I was notified that there's a copyright claim on my video. And apparently what we all think is called Moonlight Sonata and was written more than 200 years ago by a man who died more than 200 years ago and whose music is now in the public domain, which means it belongs to all of us. So we think that's what this piece is. But according to the copyright claimant, whom I don't know who it is, some nameless, faceless corporation or something, is calling it Wicca Moonlight. That's right. Video uses the song's melody, Wicca Moonlight. Okay. If you say so. So, of course, I filed a dispute, and I had no doubt at all that it was going to be decided in my favor because it's Moonlight Sonata, people. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And the person or entity who files the copyright claim has 30 days to respond. And guess what? They responded that I was wrong. And so now I can either choose to cut out that part of the video, or I can continue by saying that this is my cover of somebody else's piece. Well, it is my cover of somebody else's piece. It's Beethoven's piece. But if I go ahead and monetize this video, which isn't a big deal, I'm not making that much money anyway, but if I monetize it, I'm basically admitting that, yes, this is called Wicca's Moonlight, and that I'm using their melody. So they can still, whoever this is, can still put ads on the video. I won't get any money from it, even though it's completely my work. I conceived of the video. I set up all the lighting, all the audio, all the video. I did all the recording. I did all the editing. I uploaded. I did literally everything. And somebody else gets to say that, no, this is actually not my work. It belongs to them. Now, I do have a recourse. I'll show you. I can select an action, and here it says I can trim out the segment. I'm not going to trim out the part that actually shows you what I'm talking about. I can replace the song. Well, no, I can't, because first of all, it's not a song. It's a piece written by Beethoven, and it is actually what the video is about, so I can't do that. I can mute the song. Okay, again, not a song, but I'm not going to mute Beethoven. Or it says, do you have rights to this content? Appeal. Great. That's what I clicked on. Appeal. What is an appeal? So there's all this stuff that I have to read. And if I appeal and it's not decided in my favor, that actually counts as a copyright strike against my channel. If you're not familiar, if you get 3 strikes on your channel is out. That's it. There is no appeal after that and nothing you can do. So I say, okay, fine. Unrational human being. Again, this is not a copyrighted piece. So, all right, I click on it and now I hit continue. So I have to give my full legal name, my email, my street address completely and hand it over to somebody that I don't know. The copyright owners, quote, owners, are something called APRACS, ECADCS, SOCAN, VCPMSMCCS. Okay, what are these things? Who are they? I don't know. So I did a little bit of research, very little bit, because this is really upsetting to me. And apparently anyone can file a copyright claim, anyone, including bots. And other channels have been taken down because copyright claims and strikes have been filed against them by trolls, or they have wanted money, basically blackmailing big channels to give money or bitcoins or whatever so that these copyright strikes can be removed. Now, I'm not a big channel, so I'm still really small. So I'm sure this video will just disappear into the ether of YouTube and a few of you will see it and get angry. And that's about it. So there is no appeal process. There's no way to speak with anybody at YouTube. There's just nothing. And this speaks to something that I've been thinking about for a little while. So YouTube can't exist without the creators. And the creators' work can't get as big an audience as it does without YouTube. So we depend on one another. However, this is a very imbalanced relationship. So, you know, corporations have basically taken away the ability of most musicians to actually make a living wage doing what they do. This includes big names that you would know, you know, famous people that are not making as much money as you think they might be. But, you know, someone like me, small fry on YouTube, if I told you how much I make, you would probably ask me, why am I doing this? So I've been doing this because I love playing the piano and I love showing other people how to do it, you know, if they really want to learn. I love this, and I love having YouTube as the platform where I can reach people that I would never be able to reach in real life. But on the other hand, it's a constant effort, you know, putting out videos and working, hoping that somehow the algorithm will pick me up or whatever, you know. And my channel's been growing, and I've met really great people, and I've been able to teach, you know, everybody who wants to be taught that has found me. So all this is really good. However, especially, you know, the past year of the pandemic, I've had no work as a musician. My income has been decreasing more and more. And it seems like, I don't know, it seems like intellectual property or artistic work is held in very little regard if we look at the metrics of how much people are willing to pay for it. So if you have made a donation to my channel, or you've bought, you know, my courses or sheet music and things like that, then of course I thank you very much. And if you haven't been able to do that because, you know, you just don't have the finances, of course, you know, enjoy with my compliments. But at the end of the day, there are people who want me to basically work for free so they can get the benefit of it. And, you know, that's not okay in my book. So going forward, even though I had planned really awesome things for my YouTube channel, I'm not going to do that. Because apparently it's not even like a copyright claim for a piece of music that can bring you down. It's, people can say it's hate speech or whatever. If somebody decides they don't like me, then, and if they know how to do this thing, then my channel can be taken down quite easily and quite quickly. And that's it. Somebody else will just take the place of the Piano Keys, right? Some other channel. So what I'm saying here is I've been thinking a lot about, you know, corporatism and how it's basically encroaching into every aspect of our lives. The individual matters less and less. People are being canceled, you know, whether you agree with it or not. I don't agree with it. I'm all about free speech. There's an airplane. And free speech, even when people are saying things you don't agree with, that's when free speech matters. Okay, I live in the United States. We're all about free speech, or at least we used to be. I don't know now. But my point here is that, okay, so I'm not going off the internet because I really love doing what I'm doing and reaching you and interacting with you. And I'll still post performances of my arrangements and things like that so that you can find them and other people can find them. I'm going to think about how I'll be holding my tutorials from now on. Probably not on YouTube anymore. I just can't. It's heartbreaking. I've put in thousands of hours of work on my channel. And just to think that it can be taken down so easily with no recourse, that's the part that really gets to me. There's no way to have my day in court, so to speak. It's just somebody says, like, hey, this person is doing something that goes against whatever policy. And that's it. That's it. You're canceled. Eventually. Okay, or you can be. So, I'm not really sure how you can help. I think some of you might be wanting to know how you can help. But what you can do is, if you want to still be in contact with me, send me an email, marina@thepianokeys.com. Tell me that you want to be put on my mailing list. I might be sending out a weekly newsletter, find another place to host my tutorials, things like that. I'm not sure yet. I'm still, like, really raw about this, and I'm not a person who is very technical. Like, I don't like all that stuff. I just want to create and I want to put it out there. And that's why YouTube's so great. You know, the platform's already made. So if you ask me, like, what are you going to do? I don't know. I will have to research, add that to my million plus to-do list. Long story short, YouTube does not really care about the content creators. YouTube cares about the big advertisers and about, I guess, not being sued. I don't even know. I also researched and I saw that even when it's a fake entity that is making the copyright claim, it doesn't matter. YouTube doesn't care. It's easier for them to just kind of like get rid of, you know, the YouTuber than to try to stand up for them. Hopefully that will change in the future. I'm not optimistic about it, to be quite honest with you. Just looking at the way things are going, the individual becoming less and less important. So if you want to stay in contact with me, send me an email. Say, put me on your mailing list for a newsletter or whatever. I might do Zoom tutorials. I don't really know. Okay, so we'll have to figure out what we're doing, but so I was hoping to do like a big 5th anniversary celebration. That's not going to happen. I'll still be making tutorials. I'll still be making courses, and sheet music is just going to be probably in a different place than on YouTube. All right, well, keep practicing, have fun, and I hope to see you soon. Bye.
Wow. Well, that was interesting. That was something else. That was from the YouTube channel, The Piano Keys. We heard from Marina, who has gotten a dose of reality as to what YouTube is really all about when somebody decided to copyright a piano concerto or a piece of a piano concerto from Beethoven, claim it was theirs. She had to defend herself. She had to basically say that the video she created was not hers. And the other entity, which could have been a bot, could have been anything, got to benefit from this and reap advertising money from something they had nothing to do with. And this is how a company like YouTube apparently is run, through algorithms, without humans actually communicating a decision, an opinion, asking questions. The decision is made from some mindless computer someplace, who knows, and increasingly I find people just are having to deal with this and trying to find alternatives. There need to be alternatives. And I don't think anything spells that out more clearly than a story like this. Rob? Rob, you're muted. Rob, you're still muted.
Sorry about that. Got that. All right. The issue of intellectual property and copyright is not a clear-cut thing. It's not a yes or no thing. There are always ways and means in which people might be reusing copyrighted material in a way they're allowed under the laws of the United States and many other countries. There is material that is in the public domain. Everyone owns it, like Beethoven. There is material that is freely licensed, Creative Commons, things like that. And there is material that might be copyrighted, but you're using it in a way that is protected by the concept of fair use, which exists in this country. And the trouble with computers making these decisions and just giving people a hard no and giving them no further recourse like this is a computer will never be able to judge all of those possible states of being and all of those possible courses of events that would lead somebody to be allowed to use the clip that they're using. And when it comes to something like this, which is patently ridiculous, she's using a bit of Beethoven. Somebody else somewhere managed to get that bit of Beethoven into the algorithms as their property. Obviously, that's not true. This has also happened with an artist I follow called Hussalonia, who put out an album of public domain music. I think it was actually called the public domain EP or the public domain album, and said, you know, everyone's allowed to use this. Use it for whatever you like. And when people started using it on YouTube, again, somebody else had registered that public domain material as their own in YouTube's copyright algorithms, and people were getting takedown notices for using stuff that they had permission to use. And yeah, this is trouble, and there needs to be a way to get through to a human But YouTube is not run like that. It's not run in a way that protects the smaller creators. It's not run in a way that encourages creativity and remixing and building upon things in a way that's in ways that we're allowed to. And that as a working artist, I find very, you know, sacred. It's just interested in letting computers do whatever the people with the most money want them to do. And we end up running people like this off the platform.
And I think since Google got their hands on YouTube, it has gone downhill so much with the obtrusive ads and the overzealousness of quote-unquote copyright enforcement. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I think overzealousness is the right word here. And coincidentally, I actually use that word in a forthcoming – I'll give a peek over the fence – I have a forthcoming article about this very issue coming out in the Financial Times soon, a special report section that they'll have in a couple of weeks, and also my column in 2600 magazine, the forthcoming issue coming out, will also be about social media and transparency and rights and things like that. So it'll be kind of interesting, but I think you hit it right on the head, Emmanuel, that it's this overzealousness when it comes to the protection of intellectual property, of copyright. But yet at the same time, there are all these horrible things happening on these social media platforms, like disinformation, election interference, fomenting insurrection, all these types of horrible things that don't get the same zealous type of protection. What do we get? 4 months later, we get a decision from a corporate tribunal basically saying, yes, you did the right thing in banning Trump, but now you have to reconsider whether or not you're letting him back on the platform. And you've got another 6 months to do that. But also, I think, Rob, to bounce off some of your points, I think the real issue here is the equities and the fairness of being able to take down content on the basis of algorithmically matching content. And these algorithms, well, there's a damn good reason why, let's say, you know, Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata played by one person sounds like Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata played like another person, is because it's the same goddamn Moonlight Sonata, right? It's the same thing. It's the same notes being played in different creative means by different people, right? So the problem, though, I think, is that the burden shifts. Once you have an algorithmic takedown of this particular content of a creative person who may rely for their livelihood, as I think it was Miranda said, that to a certain extent she does, then it shifts to this requirement of human intervention. And that human intervention slows things down because you're waiting for a human to look at something, to read something, to look at the history, look at the content, make an assessment. These are things that algorithms don't do. So if you need human intervention to get something back up, it seems to me like it would only be fair to have human intervention to take it down, right? Because by the time a human decides, yeah, oh, we're dealing with something, the copyright for which it expired over 200 years ago, so let's put this back up, the damage is already done. The person has lost their content. Their livelihood has been possibly irrevocably altered.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Well, I just think this is going back and stemming from that unwillingness to reimagine or change that fundamental model, that form of business that underlies what has brought us to this point. And by instituting this copyright scheme, it just looks like they've just monetized a way to penalize people, and it's turned into a tripwire for that instead of advertisers. But because they can't let go, it has to look like something. And it's not traversing to a place that's going to work, actually, I think, for the creators.
You know what? We're going to continue this conversation, ironically enough, on YouTube in a few minutes. Go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/channel2600, or just click on the link on the front page of 2600.com. That's up there right now. We have other things to talk about as well, and you can call us at 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACK. So that starts at 8 o'clock. You can also write to us, oth@2600.com. Hey, it's Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May, and I figured I'd play something from Mexico. This is literally from Mexico. When I was traveling there once, I stopped at one of these roadside joints, and they were playing music, and I liked the music so much, I tried to ask the person behind the counter what this music was, who it was. We didn't really understand each other, but when I left, she handed me the cassette they were playing. That's why it sounds like a cassette. And that's how I remember Mexico, is people being so generous and friendly and filled with good music and food. So think about all that on this 5th of May. We will be back next week and on YouTube in a couple of minutes. It's Emmanuel for Off the Hook. Stay tuned to WBAI. We'll see you soon. Good night.
I am The Law, one of the co-conductors of the Harlem Connection radio show, heard right here on WBAI. And the three of us, Anna, Brent, and myself, hope that you will join us this Friday as we get you ready for Mother's Day weekend. We will talk about the book, The Three Mothers, which explains how Louise Little, Burtis Baldwin, and Alberta Williams King helped to influence the thinking and the lives of their sons, Malcolm X, James Baldwin, and Martin Luther King Jr. We will also play music by some of our mother's favorite artists. So, we hope you will join us right here on listener-supported radio, WBAI, Friday night, 10 o'clock, on 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.